I'm Angela Straley, born in Lubbock, Texas, to Al and B. Straley. My birthday is November 22nd, 1945. Lubbock was a pretty large town. I would call it a city. But it was still very, had a small town atmosphere. Very friendly people, very secure kind of a place to grow up where, you know, us kids would be out until dinner time and nobody worried about, you know, those kind of things back then. It was wonderful. So Lubbock was mainly an inland cotton port, a lot of cotton. But my dad was a professor at the university there, which was a college at the time. So he was a professor of Spanish. And my mother was bilingual, actually. So that was a fun environment for me because they were associated with the faculty and just interesting people. I did leave there to go to college, right out of high school. So I did go to college for 2 years in Minneapolis, of all places, small liberal arts college called Carleton. It was wonderful. I heard a lot of good music up there in the way of jazz and folk mainly. But I was already just a huge fan of blues and jazz and just from the radio. The shortwave radio that I grew up with. Austin. So after 2 years of college in Minnesota, I realized, for one thing, that, I mean, it was very academically challenging. And I also realized that I missed the wonderful cultures that exist in Texas together. And I decided I would finish school at the university here in Austin. So that was 66 that I moved back and continued. I did hear music in our house because my folks and my older brothers listened and to a variety of music. But what the way I was really introduced to the music I ended up doing was because I had a Zenith shortwave radio. So at night when I was in my bedroom, I would turn that on. And so there were, because I must say, the radio in Lubbock was mostly country and Western music, and that's what they called it back there, country and Western. But late at night, I heard, for instance, the Nashville station that featured Dr. John and the Hoss Man every night, and they played nothing but blues and rhythm and blues. There was a station out of Shreveport that was supported by Stan's Record Mart, and that was fascinating too. And then there was, of course, Wolfman Jack, who somehow, whatever the deal was relayed from Mexico, and still those Clear Channel radio stations were the reason I was able to hear this strange music that I had to figure out what it was and where I could find it, and that was blues. The first instrument I played was cello, and Joe Ely reminds me that we were in orchestra together in the sixth grade, and he played violin. But anyway, that was my first instrument, and I've always loved that instrument, and I always really wanted to be a bass player, and then later on, harmonica. But I didn't get good enough to do either one, and ended up sort of getting pushed into singing. My instrument turned out to be my voice. I never was very comfortable with that idea. I have to say to, I always tell people who ask me, who are aspiring singers, I always tell them that I was not accepted into high school choir. So don't ever be discouraged. If you have something in your heart, just try to go with it and just do your best and try to find people of a like mind that you can consort with to carry that on. Let's see. So yeah, the voice turned out to be it for me. And I would also offer the advice of, if I had learned piano or something like that a little bit better, I could have accompanied myself. That would have been nice. But, you know, things happen the way they happen. So it took, I did some research ultimately about blues, but I never studied it. I never studied music formally, ever. That was not my, you know, when I was in college, I didn't have enough sense to do that. I didn't know I was going to have a career in music. So I just felt my way through. I was attracted to particular styles of blues, and that would be the sort of the after blues musicians tended to leave the Delta because they could. They migrated north, some to Memphis and a lot to Chicago. Chicago became a huge music scene for the blues, and I imagine is always associated, along with New Orleans, of course, as one of the hot spots for blues in all of this time from the turn of the century. So I happened to like the style that was still a little bit rural, still a little bit country, and maybe a little more electric, but not entirely. So that would have been, I'd say, the 50s Chicago-style blues. And that was my biggest influence. Of course, the big names like Muddy Waters come to mind, but all of the other names, Eddie Taylor, Jimmy Rogers, Pine Top Perkins, Otis Spann, Luther Tucker, Luther Allison, Luther Snake Boy Johnson, all of those people influenced me. There were not a lot of women doing that style at the time, except, of course, with the exception of Coco Taylor and of many, many others that I just didn't know about. As I was saying, I liked the small ensemble style that came out of Chicago, and that's been basically the sort of band configuration that I've worked with. I love guitar. Sometimes I've had the pleasure of having two guitarists, not just one. And a rhythm section, maybe keyboard, but small combos, we used to call them, have been my what I've done all these years. The first real band I was part of was called the Fabulous Rockets. And Louis Cowdrey, who had come to Austin and played harmonica, that he was my musical partner in that band. We had a black bass player, which was sort of a not too common thing in those days in Austin. That'd be 67 or 8. And eventually that band morphed into one we called Sunnyland Special, named after a song, a blues song. And because there was not much of a scene for what we were doing in Austin, to put it lightly, we ended up in Los Angeles. That's where the music business was. It had sort of migrated from New York at the time, so the recording business was there. There were really some great venues like the Ash Grove and the Troubadour, which had not only folk-style music, but blues. And so those were really great venues. And so that's where I cut my teeth as far as working a lot. And, well, I skipped a huge chapter in Austin, which I'll get back to. But anyway, I sort of started taking myself seriously at the time, but I was not ready to record. I was early 20s. I hadn't lived enough to put across the music I wanted to do, because it is about life experiences and it's about telling the truth. And I simply had not really done those things enough. So I fortunately, even though I had a couple of chances to record, I fortunately knew that I'd better just see what happened. And so that is what happened. Finally got back to Texas about 1970, and was fortunate enough to join the James Polk and the Brothers Band. So that was a huge step in being forced to take myself seriously. James Polk is an incredible musician and teacher. So he played every instrument and somehow got this band together. And it was a bigger band with horns, and James, I guess, was on keyboard, and because he plays everything, like I said, and saxophone. And so anyway, it was a really, really fun band. We were pretty much a weekend band. Still weren't a lot of venues in Austin. We would end up out in the country. So I'd like to regress right now to before I left Austin to go to California. Our little bands that we had here, we played exclusively for the black community, in the black community. We played at a couple of places close to here, the IL Club, the Ira Littlefield Club. We actually had a regular gig there for which we were paid a barbecue sandwich, which was a barbecued chicken wing between two slices of white bread, and we were happy to have it. We were happy to have a place to play. We got to know musicians from this part of town, and that was really fun times. Later on, I'm not exactly sure when. Well, yes, I am, and I'll talk about the next band. Besides James Polk, which was a huge step for me, but we didn't get to play that often, and it was almost always out of town, either in a country town where people would come from 100 miles to be there, or places like even Midland and wherever, you know. But I had to take myself a little seriously there because the audiences... They knew music, and they knew what they wanted to hear, and so that was a demanding thing. So it was a wonderful, wonderful education for me. Later on, I'll just continue, I formed a band with W.C. Clark, Derek O'Brien at one point, Denny Freeman at one point, and it was called Southern Feeling. So that was a band that lasted a few years here in Austin and was just a wonderful, fun band. By that time, Soap Creek was going. That was a fantastic venue. not many other clubs, but once again, we were rescued by being able to play. I remember a fantastic gig near San Marcos where we played. It was just a rural sort of a situation, and we were playing for black folks, and it was so inspirational, and we felt so welcomed by that community. I mean, wherever it was, there were reasons for that, because blues was becoming less and less prominent. It was being dropped from the radio. The people who did want to hear it, they didn't care that we were young, white kid, middle class or lower middle class kids. They didn't care about any of that. They just could feel that we were serious and we were doing the best we could and we were having a ball because of them, and we felt completely welcome. And so that wasn't true with certain other elements in that probably questioned what we were doing, if we could do it, and why we would do it, and all of those sort of things. So that just wasn't an issue then. So that was a wonderful thing. The other fantastic gig, one of the best ones ever in my entire career, was at a place called Alexander's Place, south of town off Brody Lane, I believe it is. And that was just the epitome of that kind of a place. It was a barbecue joint, and we were fortunate enough to play there on Sunday afternoons. I don't remember how regularly. Some of our other friends in bands ended up playing there as well. But to play there at Alexander's, and eventually all kinds of people would go out there and have fun dancing and just being friends. I mean, the people who attended from the immediate community, which I believe is called or was called Kitchenville, there were kids, their grandparents, all just a wonderful mixture of people. And then whatever fans made it out from Austin to be there. And the wonderful Thomas Alexander family, once again, we just felt at home. As far as the blues tradition and figuring out what's important to do and what standards are important, because we were learning, and eventually, of course, at Antone's, we were learning from the masters who invented those styles of blues that we admired so much. The point was, we never for many, many years said, well, I'm a blues musician. We just said, we're trying to do this. So the point was, learn everything you can, absorb everything you can from recordings. And later on, of course, because of a place like Antone's, you could actually study with people. I mean, you could know them personally and be on stage with them, which I found to be the very best place to learn. To observe how they handled their bands, how they did those things, was really hugely important to me. But the main quality as a vocalist that I tried to achieve was simply to be honest, to be sincere about what I was saying, just to, you know, convey a real story, because that's what blues is about. And I finally felt that I was qualified to talk about certain things like life experiences and the ups and downs and the funny things, for sure, that happened. So those were the important things to me, was to be confident enough to convey those things, which to me was the heart of the blues and was the medicine that the audience gets from blues. They want to hear the truth, and they want to be healed by it. They want to feel those notes and those thoughts. So that was the important part for me. The future of the blues. I've had my doubts along all of these many, many years. I even thought it was sort of weird to be doing songs that other people wrote. And I did make an effort finally when I was competent enough to start writing my own material, to start contributing something back to the tradition. Because just to go on and do everything that everybody had already done didn't seem right. On the other hand, I think we were a little bit conflicted about, well, is this derivative? I remember that word. You know, it's just, is this too derivative? Are we going too far in a different direction and all that kind of stuff? But I finally sort of gave up worrying about that stuff and just really, really tried to be inspired enough to write and to use all of the things that I admired about the musicians who had inspired me musically in every other way, just to sort of having absorbed all of that for a number of years, to finally have it sort of coalesce into something I could put across. So, and the other thing about blues, because it really seemed like it was in such peril when we started. Like of course, in the United States, it had always been imperiled. It was absolutely suppressed from the radio in the beginning. And that's why the British blues invasion made perfect sense. Over there in Europe and Japan as well, those records, those artists were completely idolized. They were invited to be there. They did wonderful festivals all those years. They recorded. And so it was something we sort of missed out on. And it was wonderful that, you know, these British rockers brought it back to the States. I mean, we might have thought, well, you know, they're not doing it right or something like that. But they were doing it, and they were respectful, and they turned a lot of people on to blues. So that was an encouraging thing. And then right here in Austin, of course, particularly I would point out all those years at Antone's, where the Fabulous Thunderbirds were the house band. They got to, I mean, that was one reason Antone's probably survived, is they could invite the heavies, the Muddy Waters, the, you know, later on the Buddy Guys and Junior Wells and the, so forth and so on, all those years. And Albert Collins, I'll have to throw in there, Albert King. They could invite people like that without having to transport and pay for the whole band, because we had house bands that were up to it, and those artists felt comfortable. And of course, everything Clifford made everybody feel comfortable. He welcomed everyone and made a home and didn't have people back in the day. He didn't have people for just one night. If they were going to go to the trouble to be here from Chicago, a lot of them drove. It was going to be four nights or something at least. And so they really did feel at home here. And we got to hang out with them, and it was that has that tradition has continued, and that's why it's such a thrill for me to be back here when I've been back here and see that that still goes on, that the learning still goes on. You've got all these kids that are just incredibly good, and then of course across the world, because I was going to say, people like the Thunderbirds, and of course Stevie, who became such a huge hero and such a huge presence in the world and brought blues up to another level as far as people being attracted to it. So things like that, to me, really, really have kept the blues alive and give me every hope that the blues is not ever going to disappear. One really important thing for me in a historical way was the fact that when I started out, besides the fact that I really wanted to be a musician and not so much a singer, there weren't a lot of women musicians at the time. So for me to meet someone like Marcia Ball and Sarah Brown and Lou Ann Barton was such an inspiring thing. We didn't talk about it at the time. I do recall people would ask us, you know, it's like, well, are you all competitors or whatever? Do you feel competitive about? And we thought, gee whiz, no, we're just so thrilled to know each other, to know that we can do this, and we happen to be women. And, we ought to be closer, and we ought to try to do things together. And so, fortunately for us, that's happened for various reasons and in various venues, though, once again, mostly that has been Antone's. So that was a really important supportive thing about the Austin community. But of course, the whole rest of it is that music has always been so important here. There have always been wonderful venues. I've mentioned a couple of them, and I think another fun one was Hutt's Hamburgers, that I had a weekly, or I think it was a weekly gig at. I mean, to be able to have reoccurring gigs instead of just one night here and one night there. That was really important for all of us to be able to hone our musical abilities and to be together and heaven knows, have work. To eke out a living, you know, that was so important. So there were a lot of venues in Austin, and of course now there are many, many, many more venues. And so that's an attraction that's been there for Austin. Just the confluence of Mexican music, black music, country, jazz, you name it. I mean, those traditions in Texas music and set the standard so high for all of us. You didn't fool around. I mean, you really did have to be serious, because the people who preceded us in all of those styles were so heavy and so accomplished that I think it was a wonderful thing that we had to step back and think, let's work on this. Let's work on this, and then let's try to do it. Besides the musical venues and the various bands that were inspirational to me, the Austin Chronicle, which was before that, I think the River City Sun or something like that, might have preceded it. But to have that kind of support, especially for the venues, and of course also for the artists, was really important. And I'll tell you, to have somebody like Margaret Mosher, write the way she's so capable of just how can you describe music? How can you describe a performance? Well, she certainly could. And brother, if she gave you a good review of a record or a performance, that meant the world to me when I was starting out, you know, to have that kind of a stamp of approval, to hear things described that made you feel like you really were doing the right thing. You really were getting across what you were trying to. So I have to give a lot of credit to so many things like that. And then all of the artists who were not in the blues world, who somebody just mentioned to me, John Reed, and of course, Joe Ely, Butch Hancock. I know I'm missing people that I should be talking about, but to have those people and to have them, the camaraderie, whenever we could afford to have the time outside of our own, roads to hear each other and see each other, to have that kind of support from those kind of people. Oh, and I just have to mention Doug Somm, who was a huge hero, who went out of his way, way out of his way, to bring not just me, everybody in Austin, to the attention of the larger music business. I mean, he just kept trying to point people to Austin and saying, this is what you should check out, the people in the music business, in other words. You should check out the talent down here. It may be raw, but it's the real thing. And I miss Doug so much.